Welcome to the Aviator Zone Podcast. Aviator Zone Podcast. With your host, Captain Felipe Santiago. Flying stories, career advice, and a lot of hangar talk. Let's talk aviation.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Aviator Zone Podcast. Today we have a very special guest, Nelson Brandt. Thank you for coming to the show, Nelson.
Good morning, Felipe. It's my pleasure.
Nelson is a very, very diverse pilot, one of my favorite kind of aviators, really. That's what I feel like an aviator is, right? Somebody that flies any type of machine that has wings. So thanks for coming out. We have a lot to talk to about, and let's get to it. So tell me a little bit about yourself. What got you into flying?
So I grew up here in South Florida on Miami Beach. And as you know, there are planes that fly up and down the shoreline a lot. And so I'd see them and my jaw would drop, my tongue would hang out, the eyes would pop out like in Looney Tunes. And I was always with my head up in the sky. And I remember one time I had a tutor and she wanted to motivate me to do my homework. So I wasn't a very good student. So my parents hired a tutor for me and she saw me always looking out the window whenever a plane would fly by, particularly helicopters. So one day she made an 8x10 enlargement of a photo that she took with high speed film back when there was film. And it was a helicopter, a Bell 47, you know, the one from MASH, and the rotor blade had stopped because the frame rate. So there it was, like frozen in midair. And I'd never seen anything like that before. Of course, you see it like that on the ground, but there it was hanging up in the air, and I was hooked.
How is that possible?
Yeah, so of course, yeah, that worked. I did my homework that day. And I remember also that was elementary school. There were books in the school above and beyond. I doubt that they're in print anymore, but it was all aviation, like the whole thing from cover to cover. It was all different types of aircraft, airliners, fighter jets, helicopters, just you name it, it was in there. And I just loved that. So little things like that, I remember. I remember when I was about 14, we took a tour through the Grand Canyon in a King Air C-90. And
a tour through the Grand Canyon
in a through King Air. The Grand Canyon. So this was before the special flight rules were
very stricted. Now, if you guys are not familiar, don't just go on an airplane and fly through the Grand Canyon. You're getting in a lot of trouble.
This was 1984. Wow. So you could fly through the Grand Canyon back then, and we did. It was awesome. And that same day, we went to Nellis Air Force Base, and we got a tour of the base, red flag, got to see all that cool stuff, and I wanted to be a military pilot from then on. Then the Gulf War happened, the first Gulf War in 1991, and then I changed my mind. Then I was like, ooh, warheads on foreheads. You know, no offense to the people that do that. God, you know, love them. We need people that have that desire to defend our country with arms, but I didn't feel it in me to do that. So, you know, because of the fact that I was here in South Florida and I got to see the Coast Guard frequently and had a desire to do that, even though, you know, I was like, military, yeah, I had forgotten that the Coast, or I guess I never knew, that the Coast Guard was part of the military. And they are. And you even get to go to the Navy's prestigious flight school in Pensacola and get those same naval aviator wings that Maverick has, you know, in Top Gun. So who wouldn't want to do that? I think people just don't know about Coast Guard and Coast Guard aviation in particular. I would do it all over again right now if they would take 52-year-olds.
Yeah, no, and I for me, aviation is obviously a passion, and the search and rescue aspect of combining aviation and search and rescue to me is just like awesome. That's why I'm in Civil Air Patrol, right? That's what spiked my interest. Even though we don't do as much as I like to, that's what really brought my attention into Civil Air Patrol. And you get to do that in the Coast Guard all the time. Like, that was a daily occurrence.
And that's why I chose helicopters too. Helicopters are the pointy end of the spear in Coast Guard aviation. They're the ones that actually go out and directly assist people, save their lives, save property.
We're going to go back to that because I want to talk about some of those missions that you did and maybe, you know, some of the crazy stuff. But let's go back to the early ages again. Where did you go to flight school? Did you go to school in Florida? I think
I got my airplane training, my initial student pilot, private pilot training in northern Indiana of all places. So here's how that happened.
So why'd you leave Florida?
I was growing up here, but my parents were getting divorced, and they both decided, for my peace of mind, to send me to boarding school And it was a military school with Army Junior ROTC. And they had an airport, their own private airport. So I remember very vividly this airport. It was configured like the letter X, you know, with the crosswind runways, one of which was grass. They had three Piper Cherokee 140s.
So one was grass and one was concrete?
Yeah, one was paved, one was grass.
So how does it feel landing on grass, going over the concrete section, and then...
Oh, yeah, there's a little bump. You got it. You know. You've seen that before.
Yeah.
So we didn't use the grass runway that often. It was used for the soft field takeoffs and landings and to simulate engine out and stuff like that. But for the most part, to minimize risk, they just used the paved strip. But it was pretty awesome. I mean, getting the keys to a plane. I had my pilot's license before I had my driver's license.
Hey, you're one of those cases.
Yeah. I would have had it on the day of my birthday, but Northern Indiana in October, the weather's not always the greatest. So, yeah, on my day of my birthday, I was ready, but the weather didn't cooperate. Actually, for almost 2 weeks. I got it, I think, on the last day of the month, October 31st, 1987.
I remember when I was kind of in the same situation. I mean, I did my licenses at my age. Mm-hmm. I remember when I had my first solo, like I had to go get my medical the same day. I don't think you can get a medical before or something like that. I remember before 16.
It was age dependent.
Okay. It was age dependent. So when the day I soloed, I had to go first to the doctor, get my medical before I can actually go fly. I remember something like that.
I don't even remember where I got my medical. That's so long ago. Interesting.
Yeah.
They didn't do it there on site. I had to go somewhere for that. But they did have an examiner on site, a crusty old guy. He was old back then, right? He was one of the guys that flew the B-52 when it was new. First generation B-52 pilot. He was a lieutenant colonel, retired U.S. Air Force, and he was an examiner. He was also a flight instructor, but, you know, as typical examiners don't do all the instruction. He did my initial training, then handed me off to another CFI who did the majority of my training, and then I went back to him for the check ride. And it wasn't a giveaway check ride, but we knew, you know, I was prepared. I wasn't going to fail.
Right. They won't set you up for failure.
Yeah. No one there fails their check ride. They don't send you for check ride until you're ready. But I think it was about 50 hours, which is pretty typical if you're flying frequently enough. I know you'd probably tell people that, you know, at least once a week, if not more.
More. I mean, once a week is not enough.
I think typically it's not.
Remember, that was what year?
That was 87.
Right. We didn't have, you probably didn't have a transponder in your
airplane. We had a transponder in the plane, but no mode C. So I couldn't go anywhere near Chicago. And I'd ask him about that because there was Miggs Field was still a thing back then. I wanted to land there at the Lakefront Airport. And, you know, they had the same answer to me as anyone who would ask that question.
No.
Well, what are the requirements to enter the... back then it was called a TCA, Terminal Control. Yeah. So what's the requirement to enter the terminal control area? You know, oh, yeah, that's right. Mode C. They just had that Aeromexico accident in Cerritos, L.A., where the Piper Archer hit the tail of, I think it was an MD-80. The Piper Archer didn't have Mode C.
What was this?
This was in L.A. This was how Mode C became mandated.
Oh.
The Cerritos accident. So that, I know it's a long time ago, but it was a midair.
I thought you were saying that it was recent. I'm like, oh.
No. It was 1986 or something like that. So that's when Mode C became effective. And, you know, they used that excuse for not upgrading the transponders.
Do you remember how thick the FARs were when you started flying?
Yeah, not very thick. They've just added on to them, and they're all written in blood, so we are...
Well, that's exactly it, right? We had that whole thing with the MOC. Now that became another section of the FAR because of that accident. So you got your license. You got your private up there?
Private. I got my instrument down here at Opa-locka. Right after graduating high school, I came back to South Florida. I went to the University of Miami. So while I was taking business classes there, my dad wanted me to be a businessman. You know, he thought that aviation was like glorified bus driver. I know, but isn't it great getting paid to look out the window? Yeah. So I had a college roommate whose dad was a United captain, Air Force veteran. And he said, you know, when my friend and his dad weren't around, he said, he's just a bus driver. And I was like, oh, man, I want to be that guy. He had it pretty good. He got out of the Air Force at a great time, got hired by United at a relatively young age, and was like a 40-year veteran of United Airlines.
Just, that guy flew once a month?
Oh, by the time he was finished? Yeah, exactly. He had the sweet schedule he wanted, exactly. So, you know, I knew there was more to it than what my dad's limited vision of it was. My dad had great experience in the world, but it wasn't aviation experience. He did fly a lot as a passenger. I think he kept Eastern Airlines in business, because he'd fly New York to LaGuardia and back. I'm sorry, LaGuardia to Miami, back and forth frequently.
And the old birds?
Well, the 707s and 727s, I remember.
If you've been at LaGuardia, well, yes. Even I think now in our terminal, you can see like the L1011 parking markings.
At LaGuardia?
Yes. I think I have a photo. I'll see if I can post a photo and post it up on the... But you can see like the markers that they had to park the airplanes of all the old warbirds, all the old birds. And it's like, well, when are we going to get rid of this?
Yeah. And National Airlines. So I had all the little things that weren't alcohol bottles. He'd bring me like the playing cards and stuff like that. He also had a whole closet full of those tiny little shot glass size alcohol bottles.
The minis.
He made friends with the flight attendants and the gate agents and the ticket counter people. He would take pictures of them with a regular film camera, and then he'd print out 8x10 enlargements and he'd hand them out, because he flew every week. So the same people were there all the time. So he handed them pictures of themselves, you know, before there was a selfie, you know, before there was Instagram, and people loved it. So he always got upgraded. He knew how to really
work the system.
He did.
Awesome. So commercial license. So at that point, you got your commercial here in Miami.
Actually here at Tamiami.
You did at Tamiami. What was the name of the school?
I think it was TAC Air. Does that
TAC Air? Yeah, I've heard of TAC Air before. Yeah,
and Gene Dooney was the DPE, I think. Anyway, I was going to Miami-Dade. So at this point, I was a student at University of Miami, but of course they don't offer aviation classes, but Miami-Dade College did.
So even back then, they still offered an aviation program?
91, 92. Yeah, they had... modular trailers here at Tamiami. The Ike Watson campus that you see now didn't exist. So it went from a modular space here to the former Eastern Airlines Training Center at MIA to where it resides now. Of course, when I was here, all we had were the modular trailers, I think right here in this very spot where Signature is. Anyway, so we had a flight program supported by one of the local flight schools. I think it was TAC Air. I did my commercial single and multi-engine there. And after that, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, because I still had that in my head with my dad, who was still alive at the time, saying, you don't want to do this. So I wasn't sure. So what I did was I went to Embry-Riddle, got a master's degree in aeronautical science, which was sort of like a middle ground between I want to do what my dad wants me to do, and
I'm
want to
do what I want to do.
Right. And I enjoyed it. I loved it. I met great people up there. I loved being in that environment. This was 1992, 1993. It's different now. I don't know that much about Embry-Riddle from my own perspective, but I do.
Did you do any flying there? Or
good question. So the only flying I did at Riddle was in the glider program. What glider program? Well, Embry-Riddle had a glider club. And they had on loan from the Collegiate Soaring Association a Schweitzer 136, which is a single seat, medium performance sailplane. It's like a club class plane. Mm-hmm. So it's better than a trainer, but it's not a racing glider. It's not a high performance single seater. But it's good. It's
Does
a good
have a
transition.
Big couch inside?
Doesn't have a couch. We're referring to the Schweitzer 232, which is a very large cockpit. Anyway, so before I could fly that, I needed to go get trained somewhere. So one thing I used to love to do on the weekends was ride my bicycle out on Highway 44 out towards Eustis and Central Florida, just get away from the more developed coastal part. And I remember looking up in the sky and seeing a glider. And I was near the Eustis Airport, and I think that's X-ray 55, and I think it's a north-south turf strip, and there was a Schweitzer 233. Landing there. So I rode my bike over, introduced myself, and I signed up for glider flying lessons right away. My instructor, Phyllis Thorpe, and her husband, Brian, they ran the soaring school there. And they also did steerman biplane rides.
That's awesome.
Over Central Florida. So it was really neat. Phyllis was a great instructor. Her husband, Brian, towed, not with the steerman. I forget what, like a Luscombe or something like that. Anyway, yeah, so I got my glider.
I don't see much Luscombes anymore.
No.
The only time you see them is really at Oshkosh, you know.
Yeah, they're underpowered, but I guess it did okay as a tow plane. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so we got my glider add-on rating, commercial add-on rating then. And this was 1993. So then I was able to fly that Collegiate Soaring Association plane out of DeLand and had a lot of fun with that. That's where I did my first flights out of gliding range of the airport. And that's a big leap, you know, when you can go somewhere else and say, okay, now Flagler County Airport is where I'm going to go if I get too low. And, you know, I would play it super conservatively. I'd stay up near Cloud Base on a day when Cloud Base was above 4,000 feet. And I'd go super slow, just making sure I stayed up high, get high and stay high so I don't sweat it, literally, because it's nice and cool up there too. But, you know, the lower you get, the more tense it can be. Kind of like running low on fuel in an airplane or a helicopter. The glider's fuel is its altitude.
Yeah, so we'll talk about this later too, but we, you know, we flew our gliders together and we got my commercial rating done, which is a blast.
Yeah.
A lot of work on a weekend. Weekday.
I wouldn't call it work.
It was work.
Okay, for you.
I did like 14, 15 flights in one day.
I don't think I recommended that.
Yeah, that was, no, you definitely did not recommend that. But I'm like, let's do this, you know? So I'm like, I really have very limited time. So I said, I'm going to try to knock out as much as I can in a day. So yeah. I think the tow plane pilot was not happy with
her. Her right leg was sore. So anyway, back
I'm like, hey, I'm sure she wants a flight time.
Oh yeah, she does, but straight and level. Yeah, the towing of the glider after the 10th flight becomes a little painful for the right leg.
Yeah, then it became a race of who was going to get to the ground first.
Oh, you were beating her down?
I was beating her down. I'm like, I can bet you get back first.
Like the jump plane and the skydivers? That's funny. I was going to say about the gliding. So that was really the only flying I did up there at Riddle. And I loved it. I
it seems like a lot of
as
people
often as I could.
Do kind of that. You know, they go to Emory Riddle, but they really don't do their flying there.
The master's flying program doesn't have a flying syllabus. So it was catered to people who already had the ratings they wanted. And at that point, I didn't have a CFI ticket, but I had commercial multi-instrument and now glider. So what do I want to do? I want to do what my dad wants me to do. So I came back to South Florida from Embry-Riddle. And in 1994, I started working as an airplane salesperson. It's not on my resume because it's so long ago, but I worked for about 9 months for an airplane broker who specialized in corporate aviation. So I went to the NBAA show and all that stuff, but I realized that's not what I wanted to do either. My favorite part of that job was when I got to do a sales call and I got to fly the little Piper Aero that a friend of his had, who was also an airplane broker dealer. Piper Aero is one of his airplanes, so I could go to Tampa or something like that, or Orlando, and talk with a potential client. Those are my favorite days. You
the
know?
Flying portion.
So I had to dial for dollars. We had one of those old AT&T Merlin phones, so he knew if I was on the phone because it would show like red on my extension instead of green. So he'd say, it's just a simple numbers game. You make 100 calls, you'll get 5 leads. Out of 100 leads, you'll get 5 deals, you know, something like that. It was a very small percentage of the total effort you put in, but that one that materialized would be a nice paycheck. Right. And you just had to keep a pipeline of those going, and the only way to keep that going was to keep dialing.
Making calls.
And just, you know, never quit. And I did it for 9 months and I quit. So I didn't follow the advice to never quit, but it wasn't in my heart to do that. The people that are really good at that, they have that in their core.
It.
And I just couldn't. This whole time, mind you, I was applying to be a Coast Guard officer and pilot. It's just that
So in the meantime, you were already trying to get into the Coast Guard.
I did. As soon as I had a college degree, I submitted my first application. It was not a competitive application. I didn't have relevant job experience. I didn't have good grades. I didn't have good extracurricular activities like volunteering or any kind of leadership. So that's what they want. They want someone who's well-rounded, and that comes out in the interview. They ask all these questions. So tell us about yourself, Nelson. You know, what kind of, you know, schoolwork did you do? How well, they know how well I did. They had my transcript. You know, why did you fail? I did fail a class in college. You know, why did you fail this? Oh, that's not good when they ask you that question. So fortunately now it's 30 years later. No one ever asks me that. Please don't ask me that. So
why did you fail the class?
It was math. I'll do anything to avoid math.
Oh man.
Right. All I know is the 3-to-1 rule that we do. And
that's it. That's all. Everybody always asks me, he's like, aren't you a pilot? When I mess up some math problem, I'm like, that's exactly why I became a pilot. So I didn't have to do math.
My calculator out. The iPhone has that. It's my favorite app on the iPhone is the calculator. I get that out. I do not do math.
Why would you have to? You have a
right.
To me, like my mind, I have this much space, right?
Yeah, so it was calculus. It was tough, and it was actually management science. So it wasn't just strict formulas. It was applying formulas to scenarios and trying to make sense out of data, make data into information. And I just failed poorly. So anyway.
Poorly or successfully?
Oh, I guess I got what I wanted, right? I had to take the class again. Oh. Okay, so yeah. Coast Guard was like a hobby for me.
So you went to the application.
I did four interviews.
Four interviews.
Because you only get to use your interview for like 2 years. But if I get the report through the recruiter, and if I got center punch, in other words, if it's a scale of 1 to 5, if you get threes, you're not competitive. You got to get fours and fives to get selected. And this was at a time when the Coast Guard wasn't taking many applicants. It was during the Clinton administration, and budgets were cut. The sizes of officer candidate classes was cut down significantly to what it's been recently. You really had to shine to get selected. And I, quite frankly, wasn't.
I'm sure this is a very strong memory in your brain, but how was it when you got selected? Like, is it a letter? Was it a call?
Oh, yeah, it's a letter that comes in the mail. And I got that the same day that I got hired by Northwest Airlink to fly the Jetstream 31 out of Memphis.
So you're home, and you went to your mailbox, opened the mailbox. You had already gotten the job before.
No, same day.
Well, same day you got that job earlier, like a phone call? Or,
yeah, so I think I got a phone call from the Northwest Airlink HR office saying you can start your class on such and such a date, or, you know, there were a couple of choices.
And you were probably jumping.
That was exciting because they had a lot of flights out of Memphis, and FedEx is in Memphis, so it was possible to envision either going to the mainline Northwest, which eventually became Delta, right? Or to go to FedEx. And, you know, at this point, this is 1997. My dad had already been passed away for 2 years, so I didn't have the pressure of, you know, go to law school, get an MBA, you know, be a businessman. I could do what I finally wanted to do. And I was loving it. You know, I even went up into the control tower at Memphis and talked, because this was before 9/11, and I was talking to the controllers, like, what do you think of the Northwest Airlines? Oh, we love those guys. Yeah. They've got more flights here than FedEx. At the time, they did.
Crazy.
They were flying the Jetstream 31 and the Saab 340, and they were just getting into the CRJ 200s. So it was an amazing opportunity. You know, I would have been furloughed during 9/11, but It was a really great opportunity.
So you pull that letter out of the mailbox, United States government, what, United States Coast Guard on
there? Yeah, the letterhead, and I was like, oh, this is the same letter, the thanks but no thanks letter that I've been getting.
So you weren't even excited. You thought it was a rejection letter.
Oh, you know, I was already conditioned to be disappointed. I opened it up. I even got letters where they didn't just reject me for one class. They rejected me for the subsequent class, too.
Yeah, don't try next time.
Yeah. We had one board for all these classes. You didn't even make the cut. You know? I finally got the thumbs up that you've been selected for the May 1997 class report to Training Center. I was like, I had to read it again. I could not believe it.
Amazing.
But they don't guarantee you any assignment. They don't guarantee you aviation. Half of my graduating class went underway on a Coast Guard cutter. Could have been me.
See ya.
And I don't even like going on cruise ships. Ask my wife. I don't like it.
Do they still not guarantee aviation today?
They have a different program now, which I'd be happy to talk about. So there's something called the Wilkes Flight Initiative, and it's offered to students who go to predominantly minority schools through the Coast Guard's College Sophomore Pre-Commissioning Initiative, CSPI. Now, all the schools here in South Florida are qualified for that. So if you're a student at, say, FIU or Miami-Dade College, you could get the Coast Guard to pay for your junior and senior year of college, give you a stipend every month, you're active duty military, so you're getting credit in service towards retirement. You do have to work in the recruiting office, I think part-time one day a week. Not a big deal. Many people have jobs. This is a job where you're getting full-time pay and full-time benefits for working part-time. Your job is to go to school.
Right.
And it's almost a free shot at the goal. Whereas I had a very small goal of, not my goal, but the number of slots that the Coast Guard offers for officer candidate school for people off the street.
So you went
very small.
So that letter that you got was you've been accepted to OCS.
That's it.
Officer Candidate School.
Yes.
Right? And then at that point, when you go through OCS, then they select who's going to be a pilot, who's going to be, you know,
any number of career specialties. In my case, half of the 44 people, 22 of 44 in my class went underway to ships. Then there were four of us that went to flight school, and the remaining people went to what's now called prevention, but used to be called marine safety. These are the marine inspectors. And there was a couple of people that just went to offices, which was kind of like the place to put somebody until they decided where they wanted to go, what they wanted to do.
So four people out of
44.
44.
We started out with 50. So six people were trying out. Yep. It was a tough, it was a 17-week program.
What do you think made them say, Nelson's going to be a pilot?
So I showed up there having already been in a pilot for over 10 years. I was an instructor. I had over 1,300 hours. So they give you the Navy Flight Aptitude Rating, Officer Aptitude Rating test. It's a, I think it's a computer test. Back when I took it, it was a pen and or paper, you know, test that you took.
Scantron, and, you know, circle the bubbles.
Yeah, exactly. You took it at the recruiter office. I had to go to a Navy recruiter office because the Coast Guard recruiters didn't offer it. But I went to Doral to the MEPS, Military Entrance and Processing Station, and they gave it to me there. And, you know, it was all stuff that any pilot who's got any experience would look at and say, I know how to do this. And I did. I maxed it out. The maximum score at the time was 9. I got straight 9s in every dimension.
Awesome.
So that helped. But more than that was my performance in Officer Candidate School. So I had already the 4 years of Army Junior ROTC, courtesy of the military school I went to. So that helped out a lot. I had already been doing triathlons, so I was extremely physically fit. I was the number one person in my class for physical fitness. And I also, I didn't mention this, I was a member of the Coast Guard Auxiliary. So I'd already been through a lot of their training courses, including maritime navigation, which is different than airplane.
Aviation, right?
Yeah, navigation. So I already practiced with nautical charts and plotting on charts and calculating, you know, set and drift and terms we don't really use in aviation.
Using a sextant?
Yeah, we actually had a sextant. We did sun shots, celestial navigation in Officer Candidate School.
So I got, maybe, are you familiar? Are you still remember how to do that? Like, do you still know how to
Could use? I do that now? Absolutely not. No.
What if you, like, refresh yourself?
So what I would be able to do is, if it's a clear night with, you know, clear view of the sky, I could find the Big Dipper in the North Star and orient myself to true north. But that's about it.
So I can do that, too. I actually got myself an aviation sextant.
Okay.
So I got on, I went on eBay, I found one, and I've spent hours trying to figure this thing out.
It's a lot of math involved.
Well, you know, using the tables and the almanacs and all that stuff, but I don't know if my instrument is calibrated, and because when I start doing the math, I can't figure out like if I, like I'm getting a huge drift.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's because maybe it's not calibrated or I'm user error or whatever it is. So if anybody knows how to use these things, please reach out. But I love this
thing. I think it's a lost art. Back in the day, I remember I got to see a Lockheed Constellation, a super constellation, Aerochago, which is a Dominican airline. So back when I was a student in college, before 9/11, used to go to the northwest corner of MIA, where UPS is now. Mm-hmm. And that used to be where all the DC-6s, DC-7s, constellations were all parked. They called it the corrosion corner. So I'd go up there and I'd just say, hey, cool plane, can I, let me check it out. I got to sit in the super constellation during engine start. They're going to go to Santo Domingo. Anyway, they had a celestial site. It was a former Navy C-121. So they had a celestial navigation porthole with compass marks around the, and it's like, wow, people used to actually do this. That's why they had a dedicated navigator. I mean, these are things that we don't, can't even imagine anymore with WAS GPSs. I mean,
that's, think about an airplane that's moving Mach 8.0. By the time you may do the math,
doing cross radials on VORs anymore, much less doing a celestial sighting. Oh my gosh! But you know what? It's limited though. If you've got an overcast above you, you're out of business. And so we just did daytime. We did sun sights. We did local apparent noon. I don't remember much more than that. And I remember doing a transcription error on my exam, and that cost me my score. I mean, I didn't fail, but I was trying to get the best score of the class because I had already been selected for aviation. And I wanted to outdo the guys who had already been quartermasters on the ships and who wanted to be, you know, deck watch officers and eventually ship captains. Some of them were. Captain Matt Brown, if you're out there, he's like one of the few people that really hit it out of the park. Pretty awesome guy. Anyway,
it's yeah. People that are really passionate for what they do.
Yeah, right? Yeah, he loved it. He was a underway guy his whole career. Anyway, yeah, I wanted to get a better grade than guys like that, the aviator in the class, you know, but it wasn't meant to be. Made a transcription error, and so those guys got the better grades, but I still got flight school, so it's all good.
So going to flight school, how was that experience?
Loved it. I immersed myself in it 100%. So I lived on the base at NAS Whiting Field in Pensacola. They had what they called the bachelor officer quarters. So I literally lived. It's like amazing. If you could live here at Tamiami, if they built apartments in the infield.
Yeah, I would move in.
That's exactly. That's what I did. So where did that really pay off? With the simulators. So the simulators are usually available like they are now if you go to Boeing and Pan Am at the late at night, early in the morning.
2 a.m. in the morning.
So guess who went in? Yeah, I lived there. I walked right over. I got the sim schedule every day. And not only did I get to use the simulators when it was available for my own practice, I got to sit in and watch other people getting their hazing, I mean their training. Oh, my favorite one was a guy who had been a ship captain in the Coast Guard of a patrol boat. He was a lieutenant, which is an O3. As a student, that's almost unheard of. That's almost, it is. It's at the edge of the seniority before you can no longer become a pilot. He was getting his butt whipped by a Marine Corps veteran who gave him an engine fire and a flame out on an instrument approach. This poor kid is in there.
Turning dials.
And this Marine Corps guy, I think it was a major, he looks at me. I'm sitting right next to him on the operator console. And he says to me those infamous words, "Watch this." And he pushes the engine fire button. And it was great because I got to not only sit there through that, but I got to sit there and watch the briefings. So I'd go watch the briefings not only for the simulator events, but actually the real flight events because I lived on base. So I'd look at the schedule and I'd see who was scheduled for the event that I had later that day or the next day. And as you know, as an instructor, the brief is as important as the flight.
It's more important.
Yeah.
People always think that you learn, 10,000 hours to master something, right?
Right.
It's not 10,000 hours of flying the airplane.
10,000 hours of effort.
Of effort, right? Yeah. Talking about aviation, looking at other people's mistakes.
Like, right.
You'd be surprised how much you learn. And you just sit in the back of the sim and you're like, oh man, look what he's doing. You know, and you're just sitting there and you're like.
If you're in that observer seat, you see everything.
The reason they call it the observer seat. Right. You observe everything.
You're outside of the cone of confusion, as they say. So I got to spy. Well, I had to have the permission of the student and the instructor, but they always granted it. So, you know, because I just sit there with my mouth closed. I would be a fly on the wall, but I'm watching and I'm learning. I learned so much. I learned so much more from that than studying with my peers because we didn't know what we didn't know. And we could take ourselves down a rabbit hole and be completely wrong. I did that once with a group of my fellow students. We were learning what they called the course rules, a very specific ingress and egress for the training area. And we were on the wrong side of the road as we're plotting this, even though it says it in the flight training instruction, which you can download. I looked on Google and you can actually download these things now, the current versions of it. But yeah, it was just that crazy that we had convinced ourselves we were right, but we were wrong. We should have been on one side of the road going out and the other side of the road coming in or something like, I don't remember what it was, or maybe the wrong altitude or the wrong speed. But when you're sitting there as an observer in a briefing, it's always the right answer because if the student's wrong, the instructor will correct them.
Right. So tell me, how old were you when you graduated flight school?
So I graduated in October of 99. So I was 28 becoming 29. Yeah.
29 years old.
Was really old. 28 years old is the age that was the age limit for going to flight school
to start
when I was going there. And 27 was the age limit for going to officer candidate school. So I had just barely made it under the wire for each. If I had gotten assigned to a ship out of officer candidate school, I would have needed a waiver for flight school. And I don't know if they were granting them. So it would have been a 3-year minimum commitment, probably two of which would have been underway
on a ship.
Yeah. And it was brutal. We had to do, even though I was going to flight school, our entire officer candidate school class had to do 10 days underway on a Coast Guard cutter. My turn was on a 210-foot cutter, which was around since the early 60s. They're still out there doing the king's business. Well-built ships, but they're small, 210 feet. There are yachts bigger than that, you know, in Fort Lauderdale. So anyway, and there's a helipad on the back of that thing too. Anyway, so we're out in the North Atlantic off of Cape Cod in September. No, it was August. You wouldn't think that the summertime would have high seas and fog and sideways wind. It had all that. And I remember looking out the window, it was a porthole window, and it looked like a washing machine. And this was in the little dining room, they called it the wardroom, where the officers eat. They call it the officers' mess, otherwise known as the wardroom. And I'm sitting there turning green, and they're all laughing at me because these are all crusty, sailors. Yeah. Now, one of the sailors on that ship eventually went to flight school, and she was there with me. She was a little ahead of me. She'd started like a month or two ahead of me, but she remembered me. I remembered her, and we stayed friends. We're still on Facebook together.
I think I would get so sick.
It was awful. I mean, there's the saying that you're afraid you're going to die, and then you're afraid you're not going to die because you're incapacitated. And I was one of those people. It was tough. I couldn't wait to get off the ship. And then for like a day later, I'm still moving around on land. And I remember I had to get deck landing qualified in the helicopter. So back on the ship again with the helicopter. And it was bizarre looking at the attitude indicator as the ship is rolling, and it didn't even look real. Like, wait, what in the world? This thing's broken.
I never really thought about that, but that thing must be going like...
It was tumbling. And you're making speed over the ground, even though your brake is on, your parking brake is on. It's like, wow, what? Just otherworldly, completely bizarre.
Yeah, that's got to be a completely...
That was one of the things I did, but did it because it was part of the job.
What was the hardest thing
in flight school?
That was it, landing on a ship.
Now, in flight school, we had a barge that we landed on in Pensacola Bay. You can actually see it. It's in New York City right now. It's on the Hudson River. It's called the Baylander, and it's a restaurant. They call it the Steel Beach because it's a landing pad that you would see on a typical Navy destroyer or frigate, and it's... welded onto a barge.
So they just grab this thing and stick it on the barge?
Yeah, it's self-propelled, so it has its own ability to go from point A to point B, the Baylander, helicopter landing trainer. Yeah, you can actually go to New York City and eat lunch at the Steel Beach Baylander helicopter landing trainer. We went there, my wife and I. I was driving the West Side Highway.
So did you land on that thing?
Yes.
At some point, you landed on that.
With the Bell Jet Ranger. Oh, the flight school helicopter.
Can you imagine eating there and be like, yeah, I've landed on this.
Yeah. I told the guys there, because the owner of the thing was there. He's like, yeah, we get people that say that, they were flight students or instructors and they landed on it. I don't know why the Navy got rid of it. I guess to reduce costs because it was older. And I guess they could simulate the same thing by painting the runway. So anyway, I'm glad I got to land on that. I didn't use those deck landing skills for many years. Eventually, on my second air station at Cape Cod, when I got there, they qualified us all for day and night vision goggle landings on ships.
Night vision goggles landing on a moving ship.
Yes.
What's the ORM, the risk management chart look like on that? When is it high, very high?
So they would never do training in the red. Red was always reserved for operational missions, but it was high green.
So even on a search and rescue mission, you would fly in the red when on an RM would say red, you would still launch.
So the very first chapter of the Coast Guard Air Operations Manual, which you can download on Google, it talks about something called warranted risk. And for national defense, you can conceivably sacrifice the aircraft and the crew. It's the only Coast Guard mission where that's authorized. An example of that is the Rotary Wing Air Intercept mission. So the Coast Guard Dolphin helicopter is currently on the ground in ready posture at the Washington DCA airport for NORAD. It's one of, I think, 27 NORAD alert facilities in the US. And it did win the readiness award, beating all of the Air Force NORAD units 1 year.
Wow.
And that was the year I was there. I was pretty proud of that. Anyway, that's the mission where we could use the aircraft to interdict
for whatever
potential hazardous aircraft, like a 9/11 scenario. Now, a less than 10,000 pound helicopter against a 300,000 pound jet. But then remember the Cerritos accident, MD-80 taken out by a Piper Archer.
Right.
So, you know, if you do it right.
Talking about that, we just saw in the news, without getting political, what's going on with this?
It's tough. There's been more than I can count of separation, loss of separation, near misses
mm-hmm.
with large airplanes.
Well, not only that, but also I was really talking about what happened with our drone flying.
Over the Black Sea?
Over the Black Sea.
Yeah. So I had a little bit of experience with the MQ-9. So the Coast Guard partnered with Customs and Border Protection during the period of time. Well, they're still doing it now. But during the period of time where I was doing a non-flying tour called a staff tour, I worked 3 years without flying in between my four operational tours. Right in the middle of those four, I did 3 years of staff work where we worked with Customs and the Air Force with the MQ-9 program. And it's an interesting aircraft, very capable aircraft, but it doesn't have the ability to see and avoid. But you can work around that with other things like chase aircraft or airborne radars or very high performance surface-based radars. But what happened here was an intercept. So regardless of the intent to see and avoid, other aircraft came in, and from what I understand, they dumped fuel on it and then eventually hit it. I think they hit the propeller. I don't know how they hit the propeller with some part of their aircraft that was sacrificial.
The pitot tube, maybe?
Maybe the beginning of the radome. That seems like a very terrible idea, but might have been an accident.
You think it was an accident?
I don't know. I mean, how do you contact the propeller of
the
another...
The propeller's in the back, like, right?
It is a pusher prop.
Pusher prop.
Yeah.
I just can't see an SU... What is it?
27.
27 with any components of his fuselage hitting that compromising the airplane.
Yeah, I guess you could lose your radome, right? I can't imagine...
But as soon as you touch that thing's going to slow down, you know? Like, how do you...
Yeah, I don't get it. I don't know how that would have worked.
Do we have video of it? Is there a video of it?
The MQ-9 has what's called the MTSB, multispectral. I forget what the MTS stood for. It was like a $2 million electro-optic infrared
camera,
and it can pivot. It's like R2-D2, and it's on the bottom of the nose. So it doesn't have a clear shot of what's going on behind it and above it, but it can see everything around it underneath it. And
right, because who cares what was on top of it?
There's video of this somewhere. The difference between that video and the video that leaked of the F-35 crash on the aircraft carrier is this video is controlled by the ground control station, and there's no one in there with the phone. So when the U.S. government is ready to release that video, they will. They've got that in their back pocket.
I think they will release it. I feel like they're getting more open about releasing this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I never thought that they would release the spy balloon. I thought they would never release
it. We've seen video of Chinese aircraft intercepting like a P-8 over the South China.
Which is a normal thing. Like this happens like every day.
But it wasn't that long ago that an EP-3, the electronic warfare version of the venerable P-3 that's been in service for decades and has been replaced by the P-8, there was an EP-3 that was hit by a Chinese fighter and I think landed at Hainan Island. I think a propeller was hit by the fighter plane and it came off in flight. So they had to do an emergency landing or ditch. This was during the Bush 43 administration.
So there's a history of hitting props.
It's happened before, right? The difference was, I think there was like 27 people on that plane. And fortunately, the MQ-9 is an unmanned aircraft. So this drone is a U.S. asset. It's not an inexpensive toy. It's a rather...
$4 million.
Yeah, it's an expensive...
It's like $45 million, I think, is the cost.
That includes usually two air vehicles and a ground control station and other items that are part of a total package. So, I mean, they're not meant to last forever, but they're definitely meant to be used more than once. It's not an expendable asset. But, you know, this is why we have them. To go into contested areas.
I haven't seen the video, but they were dumping, I know they were dumping gas on it. Did you actually see the video of them dumping gas on it?
I haven't seen any video of it at all.
Yeah, I don't know if it was maybe like a thumbnail, you know, catch, what is it, trying to get your attention kind of thing. Somebody made a airplane dumping fuel kind of look at it.
Oh, I understand.
Like a thumbnail, you know, like a catchy thumbnail.
But, clickbait.
Yeah, clickbait. There you go. That's the word I was looking for.
Yeah.
But, you know, apparently dumping gas on it. You know what they were trying to do if they were dumping gas on
the... They want to catch it on fire.
They want to catch it on fire.
Yeah. That's, as the U.S. government said, it's unprofessional.
Right.
And we've used that word before with the Russians, with their intercepts, because they tend, and the Chinese as well, they get very close. And it's hazardous. Yeah. You know, if an FAA inspector had their license number, there would be a 91-13 violation.
Yeah, very quickly, too. But I feel like we've been playing this game back and forth for years, but I think it's getting a little bit more reckless. Or
it's the Cold War all over again.
All over again.
The same players. You could watch the movie Crimson Tide from the 1990s.
And it's like it's happening all over again.
Right?
Yeah.
Good movie, by the way.
So back to the Coast Guard. Talk to me about coming off the Coast Guard training and you're going into flying now. You're released, right? You finish your training, you're released to fly the line.
Oh, okay. Like I see where you're going. Yeah. So they have a training center. So you're going to graduate from the Navy's flight school with your wings, but you're not a Coast Guard aviator yet. To become a Coast Guard aviator, you have to go to the transition course, which is in Mobile, Alabama. And you go through ground school, of course, and you get aircraft-specific training on systems and limitations, and you go in the simulator. After you do your simulator sessions, you go and fly the real plane. That's the difference between Coast Guard and airline-type training. When you finish the sim at an airline, you do initial operating experience on a revenue flight with a check airman on the line. With the Coast Guard, you're in the training command still, the Coast Guard's training command. You do a whole syllabus there, starting out with a day land flight. So that's where you're just doing touch and goes, basically. Then you do night land, and then you do day water, where you're doing boat hoists and rescue swimmer hoists. Then you do night water. And that is really where the rubber meets the road as a Coast Guard aviator. Night over water in a helicopter. I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it. It always made the hair on the back of my neck stand up. And it's very, very dangerous. One of my friends and a very, very, very good Coast Guard aviator, one of the best, died in Mobile Bay teaching a new student how to do night over the water. Wow. If you look at the 6535 accident, you'll see. And it was hazardous. It was awful. And it shows that one of our best can still ball it up. And it happened so fast. It was like that Atlas Air 767 in Houston. It went from level flight to out of control in 13 seconds.
I remember that day. I was flying that day.
Wow.
I got the phone call as I was driving. I was in the van going to the airport to fly.
Yeah.
And I remember flying through the area and looking to the where it was. And it's like, man, like, what happened?
13 seconds is all it took. And I don't know the exact time for the 6535 accident, but I want to say it was about the same amount of time. Everything went south fast.
Quick.
And no one survived.
Yeah.
All four died. And I knew two of them.
Yeah.
I knew the flight mechanic, and I knew the pilot, instructor pilot. And, I mean, I almost want to cry thinking about it. It's awful, and it's not the only person I know who's died in a Coast Guard helicopter. So it's amazing work that they do.
People don't realize, like, people don't understand the work that they do until you're out there floating.
Yeah.
And you see that orange.
Even the people who get rescued, they don't understand. We used to do fishing vessel rescues, and we'd show up on scene, the fishing vessel and the person we're rescuing standing up with a suitcase in their hand. And I had an aircraft commander say, we're not going to rescue this guy. He looks fine. Now, it's difficult to assess someone from 100 feet away, you know, and look through the window through the night vision goggles and say, oh, they're standing. They must be fine. A phone call was made over the sat phone or over HF radio phone patch between the master of the vessel and a U.S. Public Health Service physician who works for the Coast Guard.
Kind of like our MedLink.
Exactly. Works very similar to that. And at some point, a decision was made to medevac. And that was done with the command center as an intermediary. And they do an initial risk assessment. But it's really up to the crew of the aircraft on scene to do the final risk assessment. And it's always their goal to mitigate risk as much as possible. They never want to just accept risk without trying to mitigate it somehow. There's so many different ways to try to do that, and every case is different. But when you show up and the guy's standing there with a suitcase in his hand, it's hard to justify it. And that goes back to the warranted efforts, the first chapter of the Coast Guard Air Operations Manual. So now we're not doing a national defense mission, we're doing search and rescue. For search and rescue, you're specifically prohibited from putting the crew at risk.
Right.
You could damage or even destroy your helicopter in saving a person, minimizing pain and suffering, but not the crew. And for property, we're not even allowed to damage the aircraft beyond the value of the property that we're trying to rescue. Usually for property, it's an easy decision, just let it go.
Right.
But for people, especially the proverbial burning babies in the surf, you want to really pull out all the stops for little kids. And usually your crew is composed of people who are parents, so they all get it.
That's tough.
Yeah, everybody wants to do that. And one of the ones I'll never forget, it happened here in South Florida. It was in Jupiter. The Jupiter inlet is hazardous with the right conditions. And maybe today is one of those days with the wind out of the northeast.
Why is it so hazardous?
So you have a combination of tide, wind, and an unstable bottom, sandy bottom that moves. And what happens is it generates large breaking waves. And people who are not seasoned boaters can easily fall into the trap of, oh, I was out here last weekend and it was great, let's go out now. And they don't pay attention to the small craft advisory or things like that that are issued to help them.
Is there a way to mitigate that inlet to make it safer?
You could dredge it a lot, but what's going to happen is the storms will keep moving that sand around. So it's not going to stay that way. It's so every scary. Time you get a big storm, the sandy bottom moves around, and it's going to win. We can't keep ahead of it. So anyway, a family of four took their boat out, and this guy was a policeman. And, you know, sometimes if you're a professional like that, you tend to apply your skills and experience in one area to another area. We see it all the time with aviation people that are, we like to use the doctor killer, right? Mm-hmm. Making fun of doctors, but it's not always doctors. You know, it's anybody who's really good at what they do in a non-aviation field, or in this case, a maritime field, and applying that experience, that confidence to their boat or to their airplane.
And it's not the same.
So he got in over his head, quite literally. I saw the whole family face down in the sand the next morning. We found him. We were looking for him all night. We didn't find him. And it was heartbreaking. You know, you don't remember all the ones you save, but you certainly remember the ones you don't. And it was heartbreaking. The other mission that absolutely broke my heart every time I did it was the migrant interdiction mission. I saw people dead and floating face down in the water there too.
What was this?
This is here off the Florida Straits.
For?
Cuban migrants.
Oh.
And, you know, we'd see the rickety vessels they were on, or it was tough. I remember one where we were over the top of customs interdicting them, and a guy jumped off his makeshift vessel and tried to swim for Elliott Key, which was like 4 miles away. And the customs boat would just pull around, and every time he swam, they would be in between him and Elliott Key until he finally just gave up. They weren't doing anything to hinder him, like trying to poke him or anything like that, but they would just move their boat in front of him, and he'd have to swim around him, and he did that like 10 times until eventually he's like, oh, that's enough, I give up. You know, he put his hands up and they helped him in the boat.
Crazy. I having a Cuban background, obviously, I get phone calls every once in a while of, you know, we have family that left, can you help us?
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, you try to do as much as you can. I think the last one I remember, this was a real thing. Like, this was like, okay, they left Cuba. We don't know where they're at. They should be somewhere here. The Coast Guard is looking for them. Can you help? I'm like,
I did that with a little airplane once.
I can help.
Not
but
for Cubans, but for another missing person, you know, who was presumed lost at sea.
Right. And having the background of CAP and the knowledge of the search patterns and the search grids and all this stuff. And I mean, that mission was like to the point that I was like, I got a crew now of people that were volunteers who said I was going to take one of our or Seneca to go do that flight because it was over water, over water.
Yeah.
I'm like, I want to have everybody on freaking, you know, anybody that I can to help search on the side windows. And I had to communicate with the Coast Guard, actually. I called the Coast Guard. I said, look, I'm going up as a volunteer looking for this missing person. I see you have a helicopter doing search grids here.
Yeah. That was a smart thing to do.
I'm going to be here doing the same pattern at this altitude and everything. They say, hey, here's the frequency of that aircraft. You can call them here and communicate. I was really impressed. The fact that the Coast Guard was like, you know, like, yeah, no, go away, Joe Smo. You know, like, they were actually like, hey, that's fine. We're going to be here. This is the sector you're going to be in. No problem.
Yeah.
I was getting on the airplane to go search. Got the phone call from the family. They found them. I was like, wow. Yes.
That's great.
You know, it's like you don't really want to go on these missions, right? Like,
it's tough. My longest flight ever in a helicopter was looking for people in the water who were on a makeshift improvised vessel from Cuba trying to make their way here. We brought the helicopter from Clearwater in the Tampa area. We searched in the Florida Straits. We went back to Opa-locka. We did what's called hot refuel. So it's where the engines and rotors are still spinning. Running. We max gassed it, and then we went out again. So we flew two whole tanks of fuel on that helicopter, and I could hardly move my legs getting out of that thing. It was rough. We didn't find anybody. Yeah. I've had a lot of those where we're looking for known people who are missing, divers usually, never find them.
I have a friend who survived, who was out diving in Belize. The boat lost him.
Yeah.
And they left. And my friend has had a Cessna 172 out there. He was looking for him.
In Belize. Wow.
And he's like 1,000 feet going back and forth. He was with another buddy of him floating, right? And the airplane was like passing right over him. He's going.
Didn't see him, or did they see him?
They couldn't see him.
So when you think about the human body on land, it's easy to find, you would think. But try that. You know, when I tell people with CAP is we go over Shark Valley. The tramway. Look down on that road where you know where there's people and see if you can find them. And that's the whole body from your toes all the way to your head.
That's an ant.
Now, when you're floating, this is all you're going to see, like a coconut, and really hard to see. There are some things you can do to make yourself easier to see. Yelling is not one of them, but splashing, making a big commotion, which also attracts sharks. So you want to be careful about that. But splashing helps. Having some kind of signaling device helps at night if you have a strobe light. If you don't,
strobe light at night would be great.
But we found two kids in the Gulf of Mexico up by the Big Bend near Apalachicola, easy for me to say, who were smoking. they were lost. Their engine died, right? They're out there in their little 14-foot skiff having a cigarette, and they're trying to get it lit with their lighter, which was wet. So they kept, exactly, they did that, and we saw it with our night vision goggle from miles away because it was just dark. Night vision goggles amplify the ambient light like 4,000 times or something like that. So if somebody's flicking a lighter and it's just darker than dark, which it was that night, we saw it. And we went over there, we got him, we brought him to the Apalachicola Airport.
Smoking saved their lives.
Yeah, so we told them, thank goodness you guys had that strobe light. You know, and they're like, what strobe light? They told us what they were doing, and it blew our minds. We couldn't believe it. And we sat there with them. We shut down and everything. We sat there with them until local, you know, authorities arrived because they were hypothermic. But, man, that was a good
smoking
one.
Smoking saved their lives?
That was probably the one exception to that Surgeon General's warning on the pack of cigarettes.
Wow. We can talk about your Coast Guard, I think, forever. I mean, how many years?
I did 20 years. I did 4 operational tours and a tour at the Research and Development Center. So
where was this? So obviously in South Florida.
So there was the Training Command, Navy Training Command, Coast Guard Training Command. Then my first operational tour was Clearwater.
Clearwater.
That's 4.5 years. So that was an amazing. I would go back to Clearwater if I had the chance now. Like, I would do it for free. I loved it. It was an amazing place to fly. I loved the helicopter. I loved the mission. So not only did we do search and rescue in the Tampa Bay area, but we also went to the Florida East Coast because there's a big gap between Savannah and Miami where they have Dolphin helicopters, and the Dolphin has a pretty limited range.
What helicopter are they using in Clearwater?
The H-60, okay. The Blackhawk, the Coast Guard's version of it. They call it the Jayhawk. just my favorite helicopter in the world. That's all.
I've seen that Coast Guard show. What's the name of that show?
Coast Guard Alaska.
Coast Guard Alaska.
It's a great YouTube. There's even one in Coast Guard Florida.
The Coast Guard Florida one. Mm-hmm. And I love that
Very show. Well done.
It's how accurate is that to what you guys do?
It is spot on. It's not contrived. It is real. It's a real documentary.
Like the professionalism of the crew and the way that they run that stuff.
Highly recommended. I think it's Al Roker Productions. He did an amazing job with it. He started out with the Weather Channel, and they did a documentary on Coast Guard aviation. It was a hit, and then it spiraled off into these. So that's great. And then they made the movie The Guardian. Now, The Guardian's not very realistic. It's highly dramatized, but the beginning is realistic. At the beginning, you see two people being rescued from a sinking fishing vessel, and one climbs on top of the other, and you do see that in a panic, and it's up to the rescue swimmer to set that situation straight. Also, the cave that they were in, that's a real cave at Astoria, Oregon, and they use it every year. They have an actual training curriculum where people go into that cave. It's called the Advanced Rescue Swimmers School. So that's pretty neat. You get to do the big swells. You do the vertical face rescues on a cliff. It's pretty cool.
Wow.
I never got to do that school, but there's a select number of pilots that get to do that. They send a select number of pilots to the high altitude training center that the Army runs in Eagle Vale, Colorado. It's just a lot of great opportunities in the Coast Guard to fly.
So Clearwater, which obviously we know has a sweet spot in your heart.
I loved it. And we got to go to the Bahamas too. We'd go to the Bahamas, we'd spend 2 weeks there every 6 weeks. So every 2 months you'd spend two weeks in the Bahamas. Great Inagua, that was one of the bases, still is.
I remember I was probably like 16 years old when that hurricane happened. And not a hurricane, the earthquake in Haiti.
Oh, yeah.
And my instructor and I flew a bunch of stuff in the airplane and some doctors down to Haiti.
Yep.
And we stopped in Great Inagua because that was the last island in the Bahamas. Yep. We're going to top off
right
there.
Haiti.
And then go right to Haiti.
Yep.
And we're landing in Great Inagua, and I look out to the right.
There's two Coast Guard helicopters there.
Coast Guard base here. What is this?
Oh, it was a great place. I loved it there.
There's 14,000 wild donkeys, I think.
We'd always have the C-130 do what's called an ass pass, and I have a funny story about that, if you'll just indulge me. So anyway, the C-130 would come from Clearwater with us every week, every Tuesday. That's how the new people would go, and the people who'd been there for 2 weeks would come home. So there was a C-130 scheduled for that called the OPBAT logistics flight, the OPBAT log. At the same time, there was a C-130 doing counter-drug, counter-migrant patrol out of Guantanamo in the same area. They were the same pilots who probably a week prior to that had done, or maybe 2 weeks prior. So all the pilots do all the flights, right? So they had all done the OPBAT log, and they had a little mischievous, idea. Let's do the ass pass an hour early. And it was amazing. They called in, they said, hey, this is Coast Guard 1710 inbound for the ass pass. And we were just not ready for that. We take our time because we know the plane doesn't arrive till like 10:30 or 11. So, you wake up, have your breakfast, do whatever, you pack. If you have 4 hours to get ready, you're going to use all four hours. You're not ready 2 hours
earlier.
No one was. So this plane shows up, it does the ass pass, and it leaves. Doesn't come back ever. So then the real one calls in, like an hour later. And then by this point, everybody's annoyed, like, where did you go?
They thought they left him behind.
Yeah. So it was fun stuff like that that kept that job interesting. People would mess with you,
I remember landing there and reading the Bahama guide, that Caribbean guide.
Yeah, what a great book. Yeah.
14,000 wild donkeys on the runway. Watch out for donkey dong on
everywhere.
Runway. Yeah.
We used to jog on the runway, and we'd see the donkeys out there. The Bahamas Air Dash 8 would come in. It would use like 2,000 feet of the runway, and that would be about it.
On the right side of that airport, there's a protected area, a restricted area.
Yeah, for the flamingos.
Is that what it's for?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's like wild flamingos there,
too. It's restricted airspace.
It's really pretty. I went back after that when I got my 135 job, and I flew there, and I overnighted there. This is like the best bonefish.
Oh, I bet.
Out there, because nobody goes out there. It's far.
The fishing's great. So my first trip to Great Inagua, I hadn't prepared at all. I didn't bring any food with me. So I fished every day. I caught fish, and it was awesome.
Yeah,
the fishing there is great.
They have apparently like the biggest bonefish there.
Yeah.
And these two guys, I would fly there every year to go bull fishing.
Yeah.
And we got to stay there. So I would remember going to the little hotel that they have there. Mm-hmm. And they bring me the food, and I look at the food, and I'm like, this is definitely donkey.
If you're hungry enough, you'd eat it.
So we're joking around because on the way to the hotel, I'm like, oh, look, a donkey. I'm like, I bet you they eat those things. The next day I come back, it's like, hey, where was the donkey that was out there? And the guy's like, oh, I don't know where he went. I'm like, that's the donkey we ate last night. Oh, you know?
I went to France a few years ago and had cheval. So that's horse meat. It was good. You know, I'm sure donkey meat is fine.
Probably the same thing.
Probably, yeah.
Well, do you know why the donkeys are there, right?
I'm not sure, actually.
So the salt mines that they have there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Morton Salt.
Morton Salt. That's the one. The one with the little umbrella, the black.
Yeah.
They used those donkeys. They brought those donkeys
in. Oh, they did all the work?
To do all the work.
Oh, okay.
And then with the invention of technology.
They just let them go.
Well, we don't need the donkeys anymore. Just let them free. Good. And now there's free there's donkeys all over the island.
Yeah, they're doing quite well.
They're all over the place.
Yeah, that place, it's really, except for the mosquitoes, it's really one of my favorite places. The beaches were just amazing.
Yeah, beautiful.
So we did 24 hours on, 24 hours off with shift change at 3 p.m. And it was great. It was perfect. Yeah. You know, I used to whistle when I packed, and my wife at the time was not very happy. That was one of the things that I learned in Navy flight school. The head of our squadron, when he gave us our in-doc brief, he said, never whistle when you pack. And I forgot that lesson one day. I'm packing, and she's like, what are you so happy about? I don't know. It was just a song I had in my head. Yeah, I still love going on deployment.
Let's talk about gliders now.
Oh,
I know we... it's another passion of yours, and a lot of people are not exposed to gliders. So I was looking at the numbers recently, and the amount of glider pilots that we have in the U.S. Mm-hmm. is minimal. I know it's a little bit more common in Europe, but here in the States, we really don't have much glider pilots.
And keep in mind, a lot of people who are certified to fly gliders
are not active.
Right.
So recently, we went out, and I got my glider rating. We did our commercial. I did my commercial with you. We talked about that earlier, which was an awesome experience. I had flown a glider before with Civil Air Patrol. Civil Air Patrol kind of spiked that interest at the beginning. But we really started knocking it out. We knocked it out recently. And it was a great experience. I'm looking forward to doing glider flying all over the country. All over the world. Why limit? But you have a little bit more experience than I, well, a ton more experience than I do with gliders. Mm-hmm. So talk to me about gliders. What has been the best flying that you've done?
I love training people like yourself. It's really rewarding when somebody takes their flight, their first flight, and says, I really want to do this. And I can help them get there. That's rewarding. But from a selfish standpoint, I love when I have a really great day and I have a nice glider to fly. So I had that on Sunday. I got to fly the Standard Cirrus, which is Steve Deal's personal glider. He let me borrow it.
I'm going to interrupt there for a second. He does get excited. I remember we were flying that 232 and we're in a thermal, and he is screaming, having fun on that. I mean, it's just
awesome.
It's awesome to see how much fun you're having.
We're gaining altitude in a plane with no engine.
With no engine, if you haven't done that,
it's magical.
Go do, even if you're not going to get your rating, go find a local club or a local glider school and go do a discovery flight in the glider.
Yeah.
You know, whoever says that doesn't help you as a pilot, they're lying to you.
All airplane pilots and helicopter pilots are just waiting to become glider pilots at some point
in their career.
If you lose your engine on a single engine airplane, now you're a glider pilot. And if you've had glider experience like, Sully, then you're set up for success. And he's not the only one. In the early 80s, there was a crew of Air Canada 767 pilots that lost both engines. One of them was a glider pilot. The other one was an experienced military pilot who knew the area. They landed that airplane. No one was killed. The airplane was salvaged and was able to fly again.
Right.
For decades.
So,
you know, it's a skill you want. You want to be able to manage your energy, your airspeed and your altitude, and land the plane safely.
Judging that distance, that glide, I mean,
there's a critical skill set that glider pilots have. When you can look at a spot in your windshield and see if it's going up in the windshield, or is it going down in the windshield, or is it staying put? That's how you know if you've got your glide range or not. It's called This Looks About Right, TLAR.
I remember TLAR because I was like,
what's TLAR?
Is this? What is this acronym? I can't find anything about.
So you don't need to get out the whiz wheel. You don't need to get out the calculator. All you need to do is look out the window.
That looks about right.
And do I have glide range to that spot or not? And then if not, can I change anything? So a typical thing you have in your airplane, we just saw an airplane do an off-airport landing at Homestead last week. Yep. Flaps down. You know, are you going to glide as long as you can with flaps down? Or would you clean up the plane and maybe glide better? Now, maybe they did have a clean wing and put the flaps down before they touched down. I don't know anything about the situation.
Right.
I know they had an engine failure, and I don't think it was fuel related. So kudos to them for doing a good job and walking away from
it. Hey, they made it. I was, it was nice to see them walk out of the helicopter.
But they became glider pilots.
Yep.
Yep. So wouldn't it be nice to have some glider instruction? You don't need to go all the way and become a certified glider pilot, but take a few flights. Same thing for aerobatic and upset training. Take some upset training. So the first time you see it after you hit some wake turbulence or rotor in a mountain area, you know what to do. It just the instinct of training kicks in.
So you recently had a very good soaring day.
Oh, it was unexpected. So I was there Sunday morning, this past Sunday, with a student who I soloed that day. And that was my plan, to solo my student and go home, because I promised my wife that we would go to Orlando later that day. I did not live up to my promise to my wife, because I went soaring instead. I flew the standard Cirrus, and I had a nice 3-hour flight, and I got up to 6,500 feet using the convergence.
You were released at?
2,000.
So 2,000, and you went up to
6,500. And I stayed up for 3 hours, and I could have stayed up longer, but I hadn't eaten any lunch. I didn't bring any food with me because I wasn't planning on being there that long. I was done with my student at 11 a.m. I was going to leave, but I just hung around, and there was the standard Cirrus, and no one was using it. It's normally not out there. He usually keeps it at Richards Field and not available to people to fly, but I, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. I said, hey, and he said, okay. And anyway, what an amazing day. It was the best soaring I've had in probably 3 years since before COVID.
Wow.
Just amazing. I remember I had a nice day like that here at a Homestead, you know, before COVID. And then prior to that, the best soaring I had ever done before was out in Minden, Nevada. That is really a great place to go glider flying. I highly recommend it if you get a chance. It's one of the few places, I don't know if they still do it, but Soaring NV, they had gliders you could rent for the whole day and take them cross country in the desert. Like, who does that, right? So I did a lot of great cross country flights out there, and the predecessor to Soaring NV was called Soar Minden, same deal. I did some really amazing flights at Soar Minden. I got all my badges, the soaring badges.
What's your high, so longest distance in a glider?
So the longest distance I ever did was the 500 kilometer flight for my diamond badge.
500 kilometer?
Yeah.
And longest flight?
The duration? Oh, well, I had to do a 5-hour flight for the gold badge. I don't know if I flew longer than 5 hours. I might've done a 6-hour flight.
Talk to me about these badges. I'm not familiar with these
okay,
myself.
Okay, so there are Soaring Society of America is a governing body for the sport of soaring in the U.S. And then
kind of like the AOPA for
right,
gliders.
Right. And then there's the FAI. It's French. I'm going to mispronounce it. But that's the international body that processes records. So FAI also has soaring badges. So Soaring Society of America has a stair-step program with their badges. So if you're at the initial level, like as a student, you could get your bronze badge, which is, I think just solo, and maybe staying up an hour or something like that. You could look it all up on the Soaring Society of America website. Then they've got the silver badge. The silver badge, I want to say, is a 3-hour flight and a 50-kilometer cross-country and a certain amount of altitude gain. Not a lot, you know, like, the flight I did on Sunday, if I had turned it into a cross country, would have qualified as a silver badge. And then the gold badge. The gold badge has a little higher standard. I think that's the one that has the 5-hour duration. It has a height requirement. And that's the one where you could do the 300 kilometer triangle. So you're not going 150 kilometers away from your departure point, but the total triangle, all three legs, you know, 100 kilometers each, but you could stay relatively close to your departure airport.
Right.
For the diamond badge, you have to do 500 kilometer out and return. So for that one, you have to go 250 kilometers away and come back. That also has
and not 250 kilometers away, stay up in the air, not land.
Not land, right.
And then come back.
Come back, that's right, all in the same flight. That also has a 15,000 foot altitude gain requirement on it.
15,000?
15,000, which is hard to do on the East Coast because you can't get above 18,000 feet on the East Coast in most cases.
That's what I was gonna say, because obviously we're very limited to the type of soaring that we can do here in South Florida.
Yeah, so in Minden, Nevada, they have an agreement with Oakland Center to go above 18,000 feet.
So everything that you've been taught in your training, take it out the door?
Yeah.
You could fly BFR above 18,000?
Yes, yes, and I did. I went to 25,000 feet.
BFR?
Yeah, well, it certainly wasn't in a glider. So there's certain geographic coordinates that coincide with landmarks that are easy to see on the ground, like major road intersections and things like that. So you could put the points in your GPS moving map, or you could just look out the window. Now, you only do it on a day when you can do that. You're not going to do it on a day when you're going to get clouds obscuring your view of the ground because you don't have an instrument package in the plane, and you don't want to have to intentionally spin the aircraft to get through a cloud deck. That's a trick the World War I pilots used to do, and they had a pretty abysmal safety record. So I wouldn't knowingly do
that. Not in the plan.
Yeah, and certainly through a freezing level and all that. No, thank you. So anyway, you'd pick your day. You needed all the ingredients for wave development, which we studied when we were preparing you for your training.
Amazing. Now I can't fly and not look at like the street clouds.
Yes.
Like, oh, look, street clouds. You know, like.
Yeah.
I have some photos. I'll put some photos up on the video.
Yeah, cloud streets are awesome, but the lenticular clouds that, you know, form in mountain wave conditions are the most amazing. They look like flying saucers. We see them briefly here, the Pleiades clouds on top of building thunderstorms. Very briefly, they're very short-lived. But it's the same process that forms them. Usually a very strong jet stream or strong wind aloft going up over moisture and a rising motion.
Everybody thinks that glider flying is just about going in the glider and flying, but weather is very intense.
Yeah. Weather and aerodynamics are critical. Mm-hmm. And for longer flights, human physiology, you need to know that you can't fly all day and not eat anything. You can't fly all day and not drink fluids. And
if you
drink fluids, you gotta put them somewhere when it's time to purge them.
Right.
So you've gotta be ready for all that. And you've gotta be covered with the sun. See, I'm dressed for glider flying right now because that's what I'm doing next.
Yeah, it's a little bit difficult because there's not a lot of space in the cockpit. There's, you know, you're very tight in there and you're gonna be up there for 5 hours. So you gotta drink, eat, and like you said, it has to go somewhere.
And you've
got to
cover up from the sun. Because
the sun, I think that's the biggest one.
The sun's brutal.
It's the canopy, right? And yeah. If you're, and I think this is also a factor, especially here in South Florida, you're at, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 feet doing circles, steep turns, mm-hmm. and it's in a canopy, it's hot.
Yep.
You can get motion sickness if you're not, you know.
That's right.
Glasses, now, I think glasses are super important.
Sunglasses, you can't fly without them.
I hate
and
flying.
And a hat, too.
A hat. Yeah, that's a typical glider pilot. A hat, long sleeve
shirts.
Long
sleeves, long pants.
Long pants. But I hate having stuff in my face.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the nice thing about gliders. You don't have any headsets either, right? So you're talking to each other like we're talking here.
Yep. Only motor gliders, when they're self-launching, use headsets.
But that's
super
it.
Loud. Once the engine gets shut down and stowed in the fuselage, it's quiet again. They take the headsets off.
Silent flight.
It is. It's great. Now, sometimes you have an audio variometer, which sounds like the thing in the hospital that measures your heart rate. You know,
beep.
Yeah,
beep.
The more it beeps, the better.
Beep, beep, beep.
Yeah. But
unlike the hospital where it's not beeping, it's...
Yeah. Aside from that, it's usually pretty quiet. You can hear the sound of the wind around you. You know, you can have the radio on if you... Not the FM radio, but the air, you know, the AM radio listening to the Unicom or air traffic control. But aside from that, it's just you hear the sound of the wind going around you and you become one with the plane. And that's pretty amazing.
It's amazing how you can tell your speed just
by the sound. Yeah.
And you know, you're coming into a stall and it just becomes very, very quiet.
And if you think about it, you can do that in an airplane too. You know, in a jet even, you can hear the sound of the air moving around you after it depressurizes.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty awesome.
Pretty loud.
Yeah, yeah, especially those old converted freighters with the leaky doors. Don't know how I know about that.
So what does the future look like for you? So I know recently you started flying commercial.
Yeah, I never had aspiration, like a real drive to become an airline pilot. I thought about it early on, right? Because I did apply to Northwest Airlink back in 97. But if given the choice, I went to the Coast Guard. I would still do the Coast Guard thing if they let 52-year-olds do it. But, you know, they know it's a young person's game. It's very demanding physically, having a helmet on your head, night vision goggles, a survival vest, a dry suit. It's a lot. So anyway, God love them. I wish, you know, I was able to do it still. But so what reminds me the most of that? Flying in a crew, definitely. It reminds me of that. And having a goal, you know, having a mission.
Mission. So, to me, that's everything.
Yeah, so cargo flying has checked a lot of those boxes for me. And I do enjoy the equipment. You know, the actual long-range flying, I don't like so much. My favorite flights are 2 hours or less. And luckily, you know, out of Miami, I'm able to do a lot of that, shorter flights. I don't want to do these over-the-ocean flights they call ETOPS, extended twin-engine operations. I don't want that.
Engines turn or passengers swim.
Right, or packages swim. Yeah. I don't want to do that. Too many time zone changes. I don't even want to spend a lot of time on layovers in hotels.
It's amazing that at least for the majority of the population that wants to be airline pilots, their dream job is flying a 747 around the world.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's what you, when you're in, going up through school, you're like, I want to fly long haul. I want to go far, high, and big. I want to go to Orlando and back.
Seriously. I know.
I like landing. I like taking off. And I like taxiing.
I had a few flights where we did go to Orlando with the 757. That's an awesome flight.
Awesome. It's like you're up, you're working hard, you're just,
I love it.
It's like a regional. And I love that type of flying.
Yeah.
Some guys like to sit in the airplane for 5 hours and just take off and land once a day.
Ooh.
And that's it.
I'll take those when I need to, but they're not my favorite. I hate
doing them. I would say flight.
San Juan, Kingston, Port-au-Prince.
I think those are long.
Yeah.
I used to do the Port-au-Prince a lot of Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah.
5 a.m. show.
Uh-huh.
Go out there.
You're done by noontime.
Noontime.
Yeah.
I'll be driving home by noon.
It's pretty awesome.
Pretty awesome.
You're done for the day.
Done for the day. And, you know, you're short, you're landing, you're flying.
Yeah, everybody gets a landing, right?
Yeah.
Which is nice. That's really cool.
I like those turns. I like flow. Sure. So, again, back to, so you're now flying, what aircraft are you?
I fly the 767 only now. I was flying the 75 and the 76, but I changed companies and now it's just the 76.
76.
Mm-hmm.
Good airplane.
It is great. It's a wonderful airplane. Now, it's a bit dated, but it's okay. You know, it was built really, really well. So it's okay. I accept the older technology in the cockpit. I'm not going to be an avionics snob. Although I do make fun of the ILS radio. It has a little standalone control head for the ILS only. So you can't program the ILS in the CDU. Like when you load your approach in the CDU, you still have to dial in the course and the frequency for the localizer and a separate control head. Why? Anyway, the newer version, the current production 767, is no longer like that. They did fix it, to their credit. But, you know, the ones that typically you'll find flying freight are older planes for the most part, and they still have that.
It's different flying, that's for sure.
It's great. It's an easy plane to fly, very forgiving. But, you know, it can still eat your lunch, like we saw with the Atlas Air.
Any airplane will take your lunch.
Yeah, absolutely. So just respect it, stay ahead of it, and don't ever sit there fat, dumb, and happy. Always think, what would I do if? Fill in the blank. Always play that game, and then you're never bored, you know?
What's your next aviation goal?
I want to do a lot of glider flying. I can't tell you how much I love it. I want to fly gliders in the mountains. I want to go for long-distance flights in the desert. I don't really want to do a whole lot of wave flying where you go up to super high altitude because it's so cold. Minus 25.
Oxygen.
Yeah, well, the oxygen wasn't the big deal. Minus 25 degrees outside air temperature. Next time you're flying through 25,000
feet. Open the window and see how it is?
Oh, it was brutal. But I wanted to do it so I could say I did it and it completed the requirement for my diamond badge. But I love long distance flying, either ridge flying or thermal or a combination of both in a nice high performance glider. I haven't done that in years. I think my last real good cross country flying was 2017. It's a long time ago.
Right.
So I definitely am itching to do it. I bought the Condor Soaring Simulator to kind of play around with that. It's realistic, but at the same time, it's not. It has a very cartoon-like display, which was intentionally done so that people with lower performing experience graphics cards could run it. But X-Planes, not X-Planes, it's Microsoft, yeah, Flight Simulator now has a glider module. And I see pictures of that, and it looks like something I'm going to have to get.
It's beautiful. So I actually have it on an Xbox. I have an Xbox at home that I rarely use.
Yeah.
But I do turn it on once in a while just to fly the sim. And I'm flying it with the controls, which kind of sucks. But it's just cool to fly that thing around. And
I had a Microsoft Flight Simulator trial version, and they didn't have a soaring module at the time. I did the backcountry Idaho in a Husky or something like that.
The graphics on that Microsoft Flight Simulator is amazing.
Yes.
And I think if I had an actual controls and cockpit controls,
yes,
it would be awesome.
Yeah.
Because obviously, for me to go to Europe to go fly gliders, it's going to be a big investment.
Why not go online and learn, in a nice, safe environment and then go to Europe?
Right.
And that's another thing is I see some really good YouTube channels with people who are out there doing it. Amazing glider flying in Europe and in the U.S. and in New Zealand.
I spent hours.
I sent you a lot of these YouTube channels, and you could learn a lot from these guys. And what was really cool about the Condor Sim is it's interactive. You can actually meet and fly with these people, and you talk to them over voice over IP. You're flying in the same area, and just in different gliders, but you look out your window
with
the goggles on, and there they are, and you're talking to them. So, you can tag along if you can keep up. But I could never keep up with these guys. So they would be doing a 300-kilometer triangle. I would do a 150-kilometer triangle and just catch them when they were on the way back.
See ya.
Yeah, and believe it or not, that's how it worked for me in the real world, too. Whenever I was flying gliders in the desert out in Minden, there'd be a group of locals that would get together and go on a trip together. And I would stay with them for a little while on the way out, and then they'd drop me. And then on the way back, I'd meet up with them. I'd hear them on the radio talking, and they're 80 miles away. They'd gone far, 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 much farther than I could go. And then on the way back, they'd pass me like I'm standing still. But they know because they fly every weekend. So what's my goal? I want to be that.
That's awesome.
I want to live in an area where I can do that. This isn't that area. A friend of mine who I used to fly gliders with in New Jersey when I lived there, he just moved to Carson City. He's a United 777 pilot. So he flies out of SFO. And on his days off, he flies gliders out of the Carson Valley. And he does
amazing stuff.
Just amazing stuff. The flying out there is amazing. You can see for 100 miles. You can see the White Mountains, and then in an hour you're there. And then you're riding this almost vertical cliff face with lift that's so strong it feels like the wings are going to come off. And then you hit sink equally as strong. And it's just people don't even fly hang gliders in those mountains because they could get tipped end over end. That's how strong the conditions are there.
Wow.
And the cloud base is at 19,000 feet. So you could just max it out right at VNE, just hauling butt. And you're not losing any altitude. You're holding altitude. And it's all you can do to keep from going above 18,000 feet.
That was amazing. When I did my glider flight in Cap,
mm-hmm.
It was a really, really good day. And I remember being myself, the pilot, and an old Blahnik with full speed brakes.
And you're still climbing.
And we're still climbing.
Yeah, day that a piano could fly.
A piano can fly.
Right.
And I was like,
those are the days that we live for.
Those are the days
you call in sick from work. You tell your significant other not today, like I did on Sunday. Oh, did I catch what for that? I'm still in the doghouse for that. So worth it. So anyway, that's what my future is. So I love to fly professionally, right? But my goal is to make enough time for myself to fly gliders. And I want to eventually own a glider where I could go out west and do that. Because with rental gliders, you're really limited. It takes a lot of trust for somebody to rent you a glider where you're going out over trackless desert. And people have balled them up out there and died. And it's just dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. And so I know why they don't want to just rent to anybody.
Right.
But I was glad I was able to earn their trust before. And I hope to be able to do it again if they're still in business renting gliders. Like I said, I haven't been out there for almost 6 years now. So I'm sure with COVID things changed. So keep my fingers crossed.
Nelson, it's been awesome to have you on the show.
Thank you, Felipe.
Great conversation, a lot of good stories. Yeah. And I look forward to flying together to some of those international glider destinations.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Let's go to Chile.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Andes. I mean, I'm really looking forward to that kind of flight, adventure flying. Thank you so much for coming to the show. You're definitely an aviator. Thank you for putting back into the community with Civil Air Patrol, with just outside of Civil Air Patrol and everything that you do. And for your service as well with the Coast Guard, you know, I'm sure you have affected a lot of people.
I would do it all again if they'd let me.
I'm sure you would. Thanks again. And I hope you guys enjoy the show. If you guys have any suggestions you want to bring out to the show or any guests that you want to send out to the show, please leave them in the comments below or send us an email. All our information is on the bottom. Nelson, again, thank you for coming.
My pleasure.
We hope you've enjoyed the show. For more of our content, search on YouTube for Aviator Zone. If you know someone we should have on the show, please reach out at podcast@aviator.zone.